Good morning, everyone. I'm Madonna Guy, and this is the Natural Alternative Podcast. Welcome. I'd like to introduce my guest today, David Scheel. David's been studying counselling for many years and has a unique perspective on how grief and trauma have been affecting people throughout this COVID crisis. David, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Madonna. How are you?
Good, thank you.
About myself. Well, at the moment, I'm studying counselling.
Yes.
And I'm just doing my last subject. And then I'll be able to become an accredited counsellor. And during my research, while I've been studying, I've come across quite a few interesting things. And basically, I have a background in arts, in all types of arts, whether it be painting or music or poetry, just about every types of art.
A very right-brained.
Well, I guess
so. Very right-brained, yeah.
That side of it is, but then I've worked as a designer also, where I use all the same methods in business, helping people work out their business identities and getting design or illustration, because you use so many different creative tools to solve problems.
Yes.
And so my background is in creative tool making to actually help others facilitate their.
So was there a connection then with your graphic design work that took you into counselling, or was there some other particular reason that took you into counselling?
Partly. There was a whole range of things, because what designers, when you do a job for a business, depending on the level of the job, you use a process called corporate identity, where you actually look at all the different parts of an organisation and you bring it down to one image, a symbol, and often a slogan, and then that feeds into mission statement, vision statement, all that type of thing. And so what I noticed in business management systems was that they're really good at forming identities. And so what I thought was, I started my own design business, and I had quite a few clients who were healers of different times, some naturopaths, acupuncturists, and a few counsellors. And some of the counsellors I was helping, I was doing illustrations, but they were designing manuals. So I started to get flooded by, obviously, the people who made the theory of psychology that leads to counselling. And I started reading from there, and then started thinking, and then I started, because I'm a visual artist and a designer, I started looking at the way that psychology uses systems. Like there's a whole bunch of standard systems, like Freud's psychosexual development, their linear developmental systems, and then Piaget's one goes along with that, the development. And then Erikson's emotional models, there are linear systems of development. And then I noticed, but in business, you have more of a mapping style, where you actually look at what all the parts of the business are and what roles you need to actually make that business into a growing enterprise, to scale it up. You need everything set out so it's scalable. And I noticed that in psychology, there wasn't anything like that very much at all. And a lot of them were more prescriptive. So when they did a whole, like looking at somebody's personality, they more gave options of what you could be rather than open options of the areas where you form your identity.
Right.
And so that's a bit hard to explain, but I need to show a textbook on how that works. But basically, my motivation before counselling was to design personality systems or identity systems in the same way that they do in business. So what you do is you make a template up of all the different standard areas of life, which are, obviously social and vocational, home life, and then self-care and spiritual, intuitive type things. And those areas of life are where you go out to. So you start at home, you go out to work or school, occasionally you come home, you go socially, you come home, And then you go to like temple or church, or even if you go in nature, whatever you do to rejuvenate, to reconnect with your values. So those four areas of life, you can work out what activities you do in those areas and what roles that you play to actually start to. So it's more of, instead of prescribing anything, people define their own roles as how they exist at home, at work, out socially, and what their values and higher aspirations are.
So do you find that people fully neglect some areas of their life? So they might be really good socially, you know, say at work, and but they might not be doing anything, say, spiritually, or do, like, is that, there that, a rule
that, of thumb? That definitely happens. And so that happens in both the social aspects and also the personal aspects. So, you know, Carl Jung defined this. He made, like, one of the best systems is Carl Jung's typology. And he looked at it rather than the social side as the individual side. And so he divided up, because it's about uniting the whole physical, emotional, psycho, spiritual self.
Yes.
And so his idea was that if you were, so his typology was basically sensation, which is body, thinking, which is rational, emotional, which is feeling, and intuition, yes, which is the reading of the unconscious mind. And so those four areas, and then they could be introverted or extroverted. In other words, extroverted means going towards, introvert means withdrawing from. And so that he felt that if somebody, and that the, and it crossed over, so you have the rational on this side and the emotional on this side, and he called them, and then you have the intuition here and the sensation here. Now, the intuition and sensation, they're perceptual, whereas the emotion and the rational, they're judgmental things. They're judgmental types. He called them psychological types. And so he said that when one was very good, like, for example, if you're very, very good at work, it'll dominate the others. Whichever one's your strongest in, the others become weak. And so that theory, if you apply that to the social context I described before, if we work too much, we spend too much time at work doing that role gets to the top of the hierarchy, and actually if it gets all the time and thought, the others get neglected by default.
Yes, and I remember a couple of years ago, probably 18 months ago, and we were chatting about it, and you said to me that because I was putting so much research into what was going on with the whole COVID thing, because I've been a naturopath for 27 years, so I was just gobbling up every bit of research and listening to all the virologists and epidemiologists and doctors and people that I could listen to find out what was going on and how I could help my clients. And you made that point to me that there was no balance in my life. Like that right. was the thing I was putting all of the energy into. So I wasn't putting the energy into my hubby and marriage. I wasn't putting the energy right. into my kids. I wasn't putting the energy into my social life without it being about the COVID thing. So I really...
Oh, that's fantastic feedback.
Yeah, so it was just one of these things that dings over regularly. It's sort of like, stop looking at the research, watch the frickin' television, you know? Just relax, put some music on, pick up the guitar, have a bit of a strum. You know, it's sort of, so I've been making more of an effort.
Right. The places where it happens very naturally and normally is in parenting and with work. Like they're right. usually the two places where people inadvertently end up overdoing that area at the expense of their the other parts of their life, which are really important. And they're important because the other parts of the life, I mean, it's true that you've got to look after the kids, right? And it takes so much energy getting enough money, you know, so you've got the work thing, we need this much money, and then everyone likes nice stuff, and then and the kids are going, we want this. So you can end up doing those two roles and virtually missing everything else. And that happens in a lot of marriages, except so people will tend to become unhappy and not know how to reignite the thing that was already there. I mean, it's just been because, like, for example, in a relationship, the love's still there. It's just been covered over by that role's been neglected in a lot of cases. And you can see, like, roles that get neglected easily are spiritual roles and value roles. and in marriage, social roles. And so what happens if you don't have those roles? Like if just say, because how you define a role is like, I am a something, right? So like, for example,
I am a mother, I am a healer, I am a someone who reads, I am a guitar player, I am,
Right. And the important thing is roles are like, over. So I call it identity. They're parts of our identity because our identity basically is our character, because the idea is to be holistic about it. And the reason to be holistic is because to enact change, right, because if anyone is coming to see a counsellor usually wants to change something. But one of the most important thing to facilitate change is stability.
Right.
Stability is the best facilitator of change, because, and you can see that even with people who are stressed, they find it harder to change when you're treating them. But stable people can, they've got enough stability to go, right, I'm going to do this now, and then take a risk. And that risk might be not working so much and maybe spending some time re-establishing value roles or romantic roles.
How do you get people out of that stress and trauma? So when they're in that survival, because I know what I do as a kinesiologist and a naturopath, but as a counsellor, what do you do to help people step out of that survival and stress place so that they can start putting more emphasis on the other things that have been forgotten in their little world? Like, well, do you have some processes?
Well, yeah, sure. If you're just counselling, if I'm going to do a dynamic process with someone, like some people will like to do a whole role setup. And when you do that, what you end up is looking at each of the areas of your life, like your social life. That's when you're out in public, right? So to have a balanced system, you need all of these parts working. And they're standard parts. Social is normal. Vocational education is normal. Home, private life is normal. Spiritual, self-renewal life is normal. And with those parts all working, that can bring you to homeostasis, because the homeostasis, like the example you said before, when you were overthinking one thing, you weren't getting homeostasis. So that, you know, so that overthinking there.
No, all, and I wasn't sleeping. I was stressed. So I was angry. I was frustrated. I was watching all these lies around me, just wanting to, you know, shake everyone.
But whatever that situation is, the too much thinking. So people with anxiety will have those symptoms, overthinking, or even whether traumatized people, that's always there, this overthinking, can't sleep. And so there's different ways. If you're counseling someone, you can just listen and, you know, be really, because a lot of people just need acknowledgement.
Right.
A lot of people just need acknowledgement, because especially if you're dealing with issues that are difficult, a lot of people just don't want to talk about it, so they'll argue.
Right.
They'll react just to stop it. So therefore, the way to get around it is the more calmer we can become, then these parts of the brain, the middle brain, the limbic system, will actually get some space. And because the thing is, the self-care activities that we do, they actually create space between so the limbic system is reactionary, right? So impulsive people, they don't have very much of a gap between.
So that's part of the brain, like the amygdala, so our fight, flight, freeze area.
Sure thing, yes. And so sometimes we're even just getting people to learn to breathe when they're stressed. Big deep in and out slowly. And if you do that a few times, it creates a gap between the impulse, because you're waiting. I'm not going to react now, I'm going to breathe three times. And by that time, your thoughts have got a chance to get to the higher parts of your brain, which are less reactionary and more thoughtful. So that's one method in counselling. And then people want to practice that, because everything in counselling you want to practice, especially if you're doing something like CBT, it's very education.
DBT for those?
Oh, DBT. I don't do DP. DBT? Yeah, no, dealing with complex trauma isn't my thing. Because the other thing for me is that the latest thing at the moment is trauma-informed therapy, and all the stars are talking about it, Bessel van der Kolk. And I've got no criticism with them, because it's really opened up a good thing. Because what they're doing, they're looking at the whole application of drugs for therapy.
Right.
And because there's so many prescriptions for medical drugs, they kind of want to do this thing where they want to get a better type of therapy to treat the people. Because they've found that people who are addicted to things a lot of them have got a really high trauma profile from their childhoods.
So you're talking like the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Events Study, or
the things that are working off that. And of course, that's really good stuff, you know, and people like Gabor Mudd and Bethel van der Kolk have really promoted that. Except while I was at uni, I ended up with really nice lecturers, and I got pushed in a more of a grief direction, because when you're doing family therapy and couples counselling, really people are more grieving than they are traumatised. And it's like with divorce, it's like, you know, kids are separated from their parents in divorce. Really what's underlying is grief and loss, because that's actually what happened. And even though the trauma stories come out and they're a valid part of their life, except really underlying that is a grief. And if it's like abuse, there'll be like some loss of innocence. There's a loss, because it's actually working out what the loss is. Like when parents break up, the kids often lose contact with the whole parent and their network. I mean, that's really significant level of loss. And underneath, you know, because some trauma, I mean, you know, some of the trauma stuff's really awful as well. Yeah. Like it's really bad. And, you know, so, you know, you'd never want to neglect that. But my approach is, it's a more soft approach to look at the sadness. You know, there's that scene in Good Will Hunting, you know, where they go on and on and on and on. And at the end he goes, it's not your fault. And what he's doing then, he's more looking at the sadness and the grief. And you can see it comes out, he starts crying. Because, you know, because you start counselling people, people get emotional. Yeah. Because they haven't been listened to, actually, and there hasn't been acknowledgement of what actually happened. And so getting that, so by giving, Esther Perel uses the word acknowledgement, and it's a really empowering word, because the ego is like blocking acknowledgement. The ego justifies, right? The true person acknowledges.
Right. Say that again.
The ego justifies, right? But the true self acknowledges.
Right. Cool.
Like, for example, if I'm, because, you know, I've married, I've got kids, just say, because it happens all the time when you're stressed and you react to one of your kids or to your wife or partner.
Yes.
Right. And it's like, you didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
Right. But by acknowledging it to them, it becomes corrected, because, like Dan Siegel, you know, family, you know, he started the whole social psycho, you know, getting all the parts of the thing together. He's involved in that. But he says, sure, we damage in relationships all the time and couples fight. That's okay, except repair as quickly as possible. And same with your kids. Sometimes you just snap at your kids because you've been working for, you know, 11 hours that day, and you come out and it's like, eh, dad, dad's like, ah. And everyone has an experience. So you, the idea isn't to become to a quiet, but it's like correcting and repairing as quickly as possible. And then what the kids see, they see an example of, okay, things can be really, really tense, but then they can improve.
Yeah.
There's no cutoff or this ongoing problem that can't be resolved. You just resolve it
quickly. A few years ago you also introduced me to those guys who developed the Four Horsemen, the counselling Four Horsemen techniques.
Right. That's John and Julie Gottman. Gottman therapy,
yeah. And I know some clients who went through, it was a lot, like 14 or 17 hours of that, and it was absolutely brutal. But, yeah, it was for them.
Mm-hmm.
But they have the best marriage they've had in 20 years.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful?
Since they did it. So it has just made the world of difference to them. And each time, especially because they've both had massive trauma in their childhoods and past, and then they're two broken people in a relationship who are trying to make it work, but it's challenging. Broken, so it was massive.
Whether you call that broken people, in family therapy, in systems counselling, they use this concept called circular causality.
Right.
So when when couples get together, they're bringing their childhood patterns with them, all the things they learned to survive during their childhoods.
Right.
And often they're just sibling patterns that are now projected onto your husband or your wife or your girlfriend or boyfriend, right? And so, and those things are well practiced. You've been doing with them for however old you are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And people get together when they're 30 or 25, and it's like, these patterns are really well
well established,
well trodden.
Yeah.
And to change them is very hard.
Yeah.
And so the difficulty is working out how to, because the reason circular causality works is that often a common example is parents bring the kid in, right? So the kid's got emotional problems, the kid's hyperactive and all the things that they call, you know, some of the spectrum disorders are very physical and medical, but some are like lighter spectrum disorders. And often, because sometimes they'll cancel the whole family and they'll find that the couple is fighting. And if they stop the couple fighting, the kid doesn't have the disorder anymore. And so what they look at in especially Murray Bowen's system therapy is that there's a symptom bearer in the family, someone that everyone just throws all their rubbish on.
Right.
Right. And so they're the person to be healed. But in family therapy, it's just working out. So like Murray Bowen, for instance, he says on a video that first he thought that you'd get the whole family in, and he found that exhausting. And then they found this idea, there's one person who's the symptom bearer. And, you know, think about families, it's pretty easy to, like, you've got to study what the dimensions of that are. But then after a while, he thought that what you're really trying to do in family therapy is this concept called differentiation.
Right.
And that means interdependent relationships with family members, because there's all these types of things that aren't interdependent, like different types of wrong attachments or difficult attachments.
Yes.
But then there's things that he called fusing or triangulating. So you know, like there'll be coalitions in sibling groups, two against one, and that just continues on. But they're not interdependent relationships. They're actually stuck together in a way.
Yeah.
And they're not completely able to resolve problems without getting really emotional. Right. And you see that
in the counseling kinesiology that I did with Gordon Dixon on the grief gauge developmental directory, it says that the differentiation happens somewhere, like it starts between 9 months old and 3 years old. So it's really young when we're starting to differentiate ourselves from our mother, from our father, from our siblings, and trying to start creating our own little unit as a human being on the planet. So it's actually a very early place, and some people don't, you know, them and their mother are one and they scream the second their mother is away from them or they, you know, anyone else comes into their circle.
Oh, sure.
Quite what you're talking about.
Oh, no, that's attachment theory.
Well, attachment and bonding is a 0 to 9 months old.
Right, yeah.
And no, but
attachment works all the way through.
Right.
So with attachment theory, you've got secure attachment, and then you've got ambivalent attachment, which is sometimes I'm attached, sometimes I'm not from the parent.
Yep.
And parents who take drugs and alcohol are often like that. Sometimes they're there for me, sometimes they're not. And then there's I can't remember the other one, but the third one's disorganized attachment.
Right.
And kids who had trauma in their life often have disorganized attachment, because it's often generational. Traumas come down generationally. So the other problem is that people with higher than 4 ACE score, in other words, 4 specific adverse childhood experiences, are often also more inclined to be less differentiated because of the disorganized attachment. They can't attach to other people. So in one sense, they can easily carry on the generational abuse patterns, even if they're just in a, because they don't know what's happening. Because what you learn when you're growing up is seamless.
I've got a friend who's 10 out of 10 on the ACEs scale.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. There was nothing about her childhood that was safe or easy.
Yeah, that's very sad, isn't it?
Yeah, and it has really created massive challenges in her whole life.
Yeah, and it will. But also there. They can be that can flip around, and they can be unaware that they can harm other people.
Yeah.
Because what they got used to growing up is like so weird that and intense that they're intense people.
Yeah, and I know with the ACEs study, one of the things that Dr. Pamela Peake, I saw her at a conference about 5-6 years ago. She's a dynamo, and she did a TED TED talk called Hijacked by a Cupcake. And basically it was about how when you've got a high level on the ACEs score, you're more likely to have heart disease, strokes, diabetes, you know, the physical effects of trauma in our early life.
So they
the trauma changes your DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the whole.
That's right. So it translates across the physical, rational, emotional, and spiritual areas.
Yeah.
And so that's another reason for developing a whole identity system, so that people can actually work out those places. Because a lot of people won't even develop a whole set of roles. Like some people, like people who don't have so many problems, they have really nice, balanced set of things. And when you look, they keep all of their life in a balance, and they do a lot of things and make sure they keep healthy and make sure they keep their friend networks, make sure they keep their spiritual life in a place where they can not burn out. Because the other thing about spiritual activities are wholesome, and they're protective factors.
You know,
and also make home life so that it's not, because you come back to home every day. It has to be a place where you can recuperate.
Yeah. From the spiritual perspective, because I know you've had a very strong spiritual life for 25, 30 years. You know, it's been a huge part of your world.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just chat for a second, and maybe you don't have the same thought I do on this. It feels to me like there is a concerted effort to deny spirituality.
Whereabouts?
You know, mainstream, politically.
Every venue?
Well, it feels like, you know, like let's just say the last 2 years, you know, the concept that natural immunity has pretty much been denied, and the only immunity is from Big Pharma. It feels like a similar thing is going on with spirituality, that anyone who believes in spirituality is a flake, and the only thing to believe in is, you know, it's like people who believe they're an atheist, they don't believe in God, they don't believe in angels, they don't believe in anything beyond life and death. Mm-hmm. It's like that is a growth industry. It feels like an industry creating a belief that there is nothing.
It's possibly. I don't know about that. The internet might produce that. The problem is whatever. So the basic way the whole thing happens with the pandemic's going, as far as I'm concerned, it's an open case study. And so I watch the data as it comes out. Right. So, you know, people made a lot of predictions, you know, a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
A lot of those predictions on both sides of this argument have turned out to be wrong. And some of them have turned out to be right. And, you know, I'm not really much of a scientist, but I think that science has always been, you do an experiment and you see what happens, and then you develop it from there.
Yeah.
And
sometimes a hypothesis comes from something you're totally not expecting. So then, you know.
That could be right, but there's another problem with the internet. It's that the internet, or the whatever you call the people who make the platforms of the internet.
Yes.
It's very clear in studies and even very large meta-analysis that the influence of the internet on people is polarizing them. People are becoming polarized.
Right.
And so therefore people are already in a position of not being calm. Right. They're already in a position of not empathizing with the other. And that was already happening before the arrival of the pandemic.
Okay.
Right. And so therefore that was already at play. And so from a postmodern point of if you want to get to the bottom of the philosophy behind that, you know, there's a famous quote by postmodern philosopher Jean-François Lyotard, where he talks about how Well, what was that again? Sorry, I wasn't expecting to talk about philosophy. No, no. Oh, yes, that's right. He wrote this article and he basically says in the article that science has a problem with narratives.
Yes.
And he says that wherever there's a narrative, science will always try to turn it into a fable and make it not exist. And he says science does this by creating a discourse called philosophy. Right. Now, that's one of the basis of the postmodern arguments, that science is responsible for destroying narratives. Right.
Okay.
And so this is written in like 1989, perhaps.
Yeah.
And so it's like that kernel of an idea. The other critique that he had, he said that Lyotard said that modernism, which is scientific, and postmodernism, which is what we're experiencing now, they'll never reach a consensus. And we can see that happening.
Yes.
Like with the polarization. Polarization says no consensus. And the other thing that he said that was significant was that science in doing that was trying to stop people from having a sublime experience in the now. So he said the whole institutions of the science combined with ideas such as the first commandment, this is what he's talking about. It's a critique on Immanuel Kant's critique of the sublime. And he's saying that basically an idea like the first commandment, saying that you're not allowed to make any images, and how Kant says it's the most beautiful verse in the Bible that you actually can't experience God. Lyotard says that's ridiculous. He says that they're trying to conceal the sublime from the people. And healers, what we're trying to do is take people from having a difficult life where they're feeling sick or they're feeling, one level of anxiety or depression or unresolved loss or grief, and we're trying to get them to a more sublime position. And that's what Jesus was doing. He's like, oh, this person can't walk, now he can walk. That's pretty cool, right? And so that's like an actual, and of course people can't copy what he did, but that is what
he did. And Jordan Peterson, I heard him in an interview the other day, it might have been with Joe Rogan, I think, and he was basically saying about how people have misconstrued when they went out into the desert and Moses went up the mountain, and God told him to tell them to create the idols. And anyway, it's basically this story about the idols.
Moses got the Ten Commandments.
Yeah,
And when he came down, they were worshipping a golden cow.
Yeah, but then in order to get them past that, God actually told them to have a snake and an idol and to make them look at it, which seems like a terrifying thing to do. But Jordan Peterson was saying, it's not a terrifying thing to do. This is one of the things we do in psychiatric terminology or in this world all the time, is you get someone to face their fear and it makes them stronger.
In ACT therapy and stuff. Well, yeah, it can do. That's what there's different names for that. It's immersion therapy and I can't remember the names of them.
Not keen on that one?
Well, I don't know, a little bit. Well, of course you do that. You do that with CBT. You get people to face their fears, to practice, breathe, practice whatever you've taught them and going into the world and using those techniques. So that is used. Jordan Peterson, I don't know if himself and some of the people he works with got the postmodern equation quite right. Because we're living in a postmodern culture and postmodernism's a critique on modernism.
Right.
And modernism was the whole scientific, monarchy revolution, whatever that was, the progressive Western culture. And so, but in the, when you study art, postmodernism's, they use Foucault and Derrida and, so obviously you learn critical theory and, except what actually happened in art was that the beginning of postmodernism was Dada, which was irrational, and then surrealism followed that. And postmodernism, the precursor of postmodernism is Dada, because just before postmodernism happened, pop art And that was like more like data. It's just irrational. You can see,
sorry,
you know, the bands that came out then,
and
Warhol and the Velvet Underground. Oh, sorry. Okay. And the music that came out then, the Velvet Underground, it was all Dada-esque, irrational stuff. And so that, because if you look at how the canon of art happened, Dada was followed by Surrealism, followed by, you know, there's Futurism, and then it ended in Abstract Expressionism. And then it stopped. And then pop art came out of nowhere, but the precursor of that was Dada.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's no point in being rational because, you know what I mean, it doesn't lead to anywhere.
Yeah.
And so Dada is the underlying thing. And also a lot of the things in the postmodern organisation were, because the other thing is that André Breton, he established Dada and Surrealism, and he did them on communist principles. And a big part, if you read into the literature, they were trying to, their idea was the same as, the idea is to break down the family, right? Which is, might have been something you mentioned very early, break down the family by exercising all other styles of, you know, being. Like, for example, Marcel Duchamp used to dress up as a girl.
Yeah.
Called Rose someone. And he was, and so a lot of them were, they were being drag queens as a protest back then. And so that's something in the history that if you study just the philosophy like Foucault and, you know, whatever those schools are, the critical theory things, you don't get this in art. The canon actually comes out differently, how the, because the visual presentation often happens before the philosophical presentation.
Right.
That you find in the arts. The artists are first on the team.
And I suppose one of the, you'll be working a lot with children, I imagine?
No, not necessarily.
Oh, it's not one of your passions?
I've spent, oh, well, I've spent,